And welcome again to the Weekly Rush with Pete, Sharon, and Dan. And of course, Pete Tribuco here with Sharon Mon. And she's actually not even in the studio. She is in beautiful Daytona, Florida right now as we speak. And of course, Dan Fritz, unfortunately, is stuck,
in the snow.
He's stuck in the studio with me right now. But yeah, we've got some special music for this new guest, an amazing man. And I have to do this, unfortunately, because I'm a big space fanatic. But I wanted to let you know that we have this individual, a gentleman who you probably all know, probably all saw in the movies as far as what he has done. We have with us Apollo 13 astronaut and, to borrow from the movie, Renaissance man, Fred Hayes with us. Now, Fred obviously has done so much over the years. He is one of only 24 men who have actually gone to the moon. And his space time was 5 days, 22 hours, and something like 32 minutes. He would have been the sixth man.
So incredible.
I'm sorry?
So incredible.
Yes. He would have been the sixth man to actually walk on the moon. And unfortunately, that honor would have gone to the Apollo 14 and Edgar Mitchell. But in that time period, as we all know, we've all seen the movie. We know what happens at that point. He has done an amazing job, all three of them. Lovell, of course, himself, and Swigert to get back to the Earth and safely done. But it doesn't just end there. This individual has done so much. He's been a U.S. Marine Corps and U.S. Air Force pilot, test pilot. He has also done, and this is really close to my heart, we all remember the space shuttle program. Well, this individual again, Fred, you've done it all. Had five space shuttle approach landing test flights in the space shuttle Endeavour, with the first one being with Gordon Fullerton, to actually create the entire space shuttle program. So, I mean, an amazing accomplishment. Fred, we are so, I mean, if you come to the studio, both myself and Dan here, we got our mouths open. We just can't believe we have somebody like you on our show. Thank you for coming, Fred. We do appreciate it.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, and good morning here in, I guess, warmer Houston than where you are.
Yes, I've been there. It's beautiful. Houston's actually beautiful. I've been actually, to the Space Center many, many times in that area. A couple of questions for you. Obviously, before we even get into the space program, you were a U.S. Marine Corps pilot, fighter pilot. You were a test pilot. You did all that stuff. How does that happen? I mean, normally somebody stays with one faction, the Marine Corps or the Navy or the Air Force. How did that happen that you ended up actually being a test pilot for both the Air Force and the Marine Corps?
Well, no, I was not a test pilot when I was in the military. I was a test pilot for NASA.
Oh, that's right. You were a fighter pilot for both Marine Corps and Air Force.
I was a fighter pilot in the Marines, two Marine fighter squadrons. And when I went back to school at the University of Oklahoma, the nearest, closest reserve unit I could get into was an Air National Guard unit at Oklahoma City from Norman, Oklahoma. And so I transferred my commission at that time to the Air Force. So I was flying with the Oklahoma Air National Guard, also fighters. And when I went to join NASA as a test pilot, I transferred to the Ohio Air National Guard, also fighters at Mansfield, Ohio. And I was recalled into the Air Force during the second Berlin crisis in the Cold War. So I served a year in the Air Force in the Tactical Air Command and Fighter Squadron. So that's how I ended up in two different military active duty times. But I was really a test pilot for NASA, where I started in 1959 at Lewis Research Center. Then went to Edwards Air Force Base, where the X-15 was going on.
Wow.
That was NASA's premier aircraft test operation at Flight Research Center. And actually, I was following Neil Armstrong by about 3 years. Neil served as a NASA test pilot at both of those same facilities. He started at Lewis. He went to Edwards, and then he went into the program, and I just followed Neil along about 3 years behind.
Wow, that's pretty cool. What type of aircraft did you fly? Did you fly the F-4s or the A-4s, or what fighter aircraft did you fly?
Okay, I was a little older than that, but no, I've flown all total about 81 types.
Wow.
Just fighters, but bombers, transports, helicopters, gliders, obviously, but sports gliders as well. So no, I've flown a good number of the Century Series aircraft. I only had one flight in an F-4.
Okay.
And I was slated to fly a flight in an F-16, a prototype that the Air Force had finished testing, that Joe Engel actually had arranged for us approach and landing test pilots to fly. And unfortunately, it crashed several weeks before we were going to cycle through for at least one flight in the net. So I did not get to, and I did not get, obviously, to fly any of the later aircraft.
Those Century aircraft, what did you think of those? I mean, obviously, there were so many of them. What were they like?
Well, they were, in that day and age, they were obviously the fastest thing around. And
yeah.
I flew the 101. I flew the 106. I flew an A-7, so that vintage aircraft, and I said one flight in an F-4.
You flew the 101, the F-101.
Yeah, the Voodoo.
The Voodoo was an incredible aircraft. That was used during Vietnam a lot, in fact, for bombing missions and stuff, right?
Well, that plus reconnaissance.
Yes.
Also flew, had probably the most hours, and the F-104, the Starfighter, because...
oh, my goodness.
With NASA, we used it as a chase aircraft for the X-15 and did several other programs using that aircraft.
That's true. In fact, the F-104 was the plane that was used in The Right Stuff, I believe, trying to get the altitude record that was there. It was the first Mach 2 aircraft that we actually had. And unfortunately, because of the small wings, it was a very, from what I hear, again, I didn't fly it, but from what I hear, it was a very difficult airplane on takeoff and landing.
No, not really, as long as you had all the stability augmentation on. It handled very nice. But of course, the drawback with the little wings you mentioned was it was not a very maneuverable, as far as turn radius.
Sure.
It was not a good fighter. It was really, I think, kind of meant initially with the thoughts of being an interceptor, which obviously could go fast.
Oh, it was definitely fast. In fact, it, like I said, it's the first Mach 2 aircraft. It's a beautiful aircraft. I was told that if you touched the front of the wing, it was so thin and pretty sharp. Is that true, that it was that sharp in the front end or the front edge of the wing?
It was sharp, not like a razor blade, but it was sharp that if you bumped into it, like your head walking around the aircraft. So they normally kept a glove that they slipped over the leading edge of the wing when it was parked, so you didn't have that hazard if you accidentally bumped your head into it.
Wow.
But no, it was not razor sharp, but definitely compared to most aircraft, it didn't have a rounded facet to the wing.
Well, thank you. We have a whole bunch of people that want to ask questions. Sharon, you got a question for Fred?
Oh, I have so many questions. First of all, Fred, what a pleasure. I have been so excited about this interview, and thank you so much. You're an American hero, and thank you so much for coming on the show. My question is probably a question that many people have wanted to ask you. Did you know that you were going to have a career of this magnitude? And did you feel, way back when, how did you become interested in becoming an astronaut and with the whole program? What was the impetus behind that?
Well, that's a pretty long trail. But if you go way back, of course, even to when I was in college back in Oklahoma, I'd done my military time, and I was back in school to get an engineering degree because I wanted to, was interested in becoming a test pilot. Up to that time, there was no space program.
Uh-huh.
And then Sputnik actually came along while I was in the University of Oklahoma, working on my engineering degree in aeronautical engineering. And when I joined NASA in 59 as a test pilot, and that was not quite, but almost 1 year from when NASA became NASA, because it was NACA, which I really, when I was thinking about joining the agency back in Oklahoma as a test pilot, it was still NACA. It wasn't NASA yet. But by 59, they had actually, the year before, I think 58 sometime, they picked the original seven astronauts. So the space program had arrived at the time I joined NASA, but barely.
And did
but
you
as
know?
Far as, what got, as far as got me in that direction, I had no dreams as a child or growing up all the way through, as I said, of becoming an astronaut. I really actually sort of backed into the flying business because of the war. The Korean War was going on when I graduated from 2 years of college. I was actually majoring in journalism. And had thoughts of, because I worked summers on a newspaper in a daily newspaper in Biloxi, Mississippi. And to get, my dad had always encouraged me to become a officer, to get a commission. And with 2 years of college, at the age I was 18, the only program that fit to, that led to a commission was a Naval Aviation Cadet program.
Okay.
So that's why I joined in that October of 1952, mainly with the thought of getting a commission, not from the flying interest aspect. I had never been in an airplane in my life.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I was really driven to become an officer, and that was the route to do that. And but it was kind of thing that was life changing, because the first time I flew, Hank Chenard was my instructor and took me up in a SNJ, which is a Navy T-6 trainer. It was like magic.
Really?
Flying. And so that right then I decided my career ahead was going to be in aviation.
Now, Fred, when you talk about being a naval aviator, and obviously we're going to be making a lot of movie references, especially to the Apollo 13, but you mentioned Naval Aviator. Some people may think, no, as far as Top Gun. What was it that put you between regular Naval Aviator and then wanting to be a test pilot for aircrafts that had yet to be tried, but yet you're willing to get into them and be the first one, thus the title, a test pilot? How did that ever come to fruition?
Well, I, as I was flying in the military in those two squadrons, I, you know, obviously talked to people, some who had even been through the Navy test pilot school that were in the unit, and that kind of interested me. I read some books about the business, mainly with the X series aircraft work that had been done at Edwards, and that's what sparked my interest to say, because I was kind of making a at that time, thinking of, should I stay and make a career in the military, in the Marine Corps, or should I think of this other thing, of, in this case, of being a test pilot outside of the military career. And I decided on the latter. And that, of course, is what drove me to go back to school, because my 2 years of journalism in college didn't apply to being a test pilot. You needed to be an engineer as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's
and
true.
So that's what drove me back to school, and I flew with the Guard to keep my proficiency up in high, relatively high-performance aircraft of that day, and while I was going to school. And so then I was, as I say, I searched around, and my squadron commander in that Oklahoma unit, at one time had worked as an engineer at NASA Langley.
Okay.
Well, actually, NACA Langley, in his earlier life. And he was the one that sort of encouraged me to think about going to NACA, as we were talking at that time in the mid-50s, rather than going to a company, because he said you'll get more variety of test programs, fly different, more types of aircraft, whereas a company, you get sort of locked in on the design development of a new aircraft that might tie you up just for that aircraft for a number of years before you actually do the test program.
Wow.
So anyway, that's what made me think of applying to, as it became, NASA. And the only opening at the time was Lewis Research Center, so that's how I ended up there.
That's really interesting. You know, we're talking with Apollo 13 astronaut, and of course, I hate to do this, but it's part of the movie, and Renaissance man, Fred Hage, Fredo, from the Apollo 13 mission, of course. And we will be back talking with him about Apollo 13 and what happened there right after this.
This is a public service announcement test from TakeMeFishing.org to determine if you need a fishing license and boat registration before heading out on the water. Let's begin. Are you a bear? Do you have a beak? Does your name rhyme with Auld Beagle? Do you dart in front of cars? Here's a tough one. Do you have plumage? Do you rub your body against things to mark them? Do you have webbed feet? No, I mean like a... Were you hatched? Do you have fur? I'm not talking back hair. Does your boat fly south for the winter with the other boats? Regardless of how you answer, you need to be licensed and registered because it helps local conservation efforts protect the very natural resources you enjoy boating and fishing in for generations to come. Do your part at TakeMeFishing.org.
And welcome back to the Weekly Rush with Pete, Sharon, and Dan on WWDB AM 860 Talk Radio. We are with Apollo 13 astronaut, and you all know him. We all know. We all see all the movies, and we know what's going on with Apollo 13 and the mission, and one of the greatest missions out there. Even though it was deemed as a successful failure, it was eye-opening. And we've got Fred Hayes with us. Fred, how are you doing? And I see you're in you're down in Houston these days. How's the weather down there?
It's a bit chilly today. I think it was 37 this morning, 37 degrees. But we're going to be unusually below freezing.
Oh my goodness!
Monday, I think, and Tuesday nights both, which is doesn't happen too often in Houston.
No, it doesn't. Last time I was there, I was actually at Johnson Space Center several times to interview some of the space shuttle astronauts and then later on the SpaceX people. And I tell you, it's always been hot down there, so to hear that is absolutely amazing that Houston could actually get that cold. What I did want to go into is we talked about your military career, the aircraft that you flew, how you got into the program. Now we get to the real meat of this interview and of what you've done. Obviously, you got into the space program. You went through the whole program. I have been following it since probably the latter part of Gemini is when I was old enough to actually be able to watch the television. And you know, of course, we were all there July 20th, 1969, when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon and walked on the moon. And from that point on, and from what I understand, you were already in the program. You were backup for Apollo 8, even before Apollo 13. And then, of course, Apollo 13. What I wanted to talk to you about is, in the movie, the way it was slated was that, of course, it was going to be you, it was going to be Lovell, and it was going to be Ken Mattingly. And unfortunately, that didn't happen because they thought he was going to get the measles. And, of course, Jack Swigert came on board. He was backup for your crew. What was that like 2 days before, or several days before, getting a new crew member going to the moon? What was that like?
Well, it was emotional that whole week, actually, leading up, because the thought of we might have the measles, we'd been exposed to the measles from Charlie Duke, who had attended a birthday party with his son and been exposed. Because backup and prime crews, they gather almost every day and maybe just in meetings of some sort. And so we all were exposed. And there was the blood samples taken not every morning, but about every other morning to look at our specimens and decide which of us might have enough antibodies to be safe to not get contracted with this, amazingly, a threat of a virus, because the threat, German measles, is a virus, and that we're having today, not a worse one, of course. And it turned out Ken Mattingly had never had virus as a child. So he didn't have any of the safeguards in his system, and that's why they made the change. Now, I say it was emotionally not, it was not a mission success or worrying about Jack performing the mission. As backups, most people maybe don't realize that. We trained equally. We could have changed out a whole crew.
Okay.
The week before and a week of a launch. We trained equally. I felt highly qualified. I was a backup on both 8 and 11. And I felt I could have replaced the prime crewman and flown the mission just as well. And same way for Jack Swigert. So I wasn't that kind of concerned, but it was unfair to the people because emotionally for them, I just haven't been through that cycle as a backup. I knew the backup, like Jack, had sort of backed away several weeks or so from the mission thinking, I'm not going to get to go fly. I've done all this work to go to get ready to fly, but yet somebody else is going to go fly the mission. So to take away from this disappointment, mentally you sort of back away and say, well, that's the way it is. I'm going to back up and the other guy's going to go fly. So it was, he didn't prepare, obviously, for the launch, so he didn't have time to invite friends and family.
Sure.
And Jack was a bachelor, so he probably had a girlfriend or two.
Uh-huh.
And so he didn't have time. It took time to prepare his personal preference kit. You were allowed to take in a very small volume and weight.
Sure.
Items that you may have acquired from family and friends again to take on the mission and award them when you got back. And he didn't have time. That took me, I'd say I made phone calls to various people and family over 2 months before the launch, preparing what I would take. And, of course, that got lost. Ken Mattingly had done that, and all his CPK, personal preference kit, was packed on board.
Oh, my
Jack
goodness.
Jack didn't have one.
Well, that's...
Similarly, Ken had family and friends, people with booked airline tickets and motels and hotels reserved, and they were now coming to the launch to watch the wrong person launch.
Yeah.
So it's more of that. It was more of that kind of thing and that shuffle, but severe disappointment for Ken, because now on the converse side, the prime crew guy really says, wow, the day is really here. I've done all this work, and again, through a previous mission, Ken had also been the backup with us on 11, Jim
really?
Lovell and I. So he had prepared. Now this is his second mission to go fly, and now at the 11th hour, he wasn't going to get to go fly it.
Yeah, but he did get to go up. I mean, that was something else. I mean, he was on a different mission, but he was able to do that. Another question for you, and obviously, we've seen the movie, obviously, Apollo 13, 1995, with Tom Hanks, Bill Paxton, Kevin Bacon, of course, Gary Sinise. $355 million that movie grossed. I can't think of anyone that has not seen that movie. Were you involved in any of, the research on that, or did they come to you? Did you ever meet any of the actors, especially Bill Paxton, who played you? Did you ever meet those people while they were filming this movie?
No, a couple of months before they started filming, I hosted a meeting at an office I had down by Kennedy. At that time I was with Northrop Grumman. I was president of Grumman Technical Services and a subsidiary company of Grumman, the big company, and hosted Ron Howard, and he actually brought one of his daughters with him, and Tom Hanks, the assistant director and the producer. They had, by that time, had reviewed material NASA had given them, a mission report, all the air-to-ground they had had to listen to, that kind of stuff. And they had a notebook. They had questions specifically for me to kind of get my reading between the lines, so to speak, of what they had gotten out of their review. So that was it. It was just a luncheon. I had lunch brought in and had a luncheon kind of meeting doing that. I was never directly involved in the filming. Sometime later, maybe a month later or so, Ron came back, Mo, with camera people to survey places at Kennedy they might use for filming, for certain scenes they had in mind. And he brought along Bill Paxton, who I got to host for a day or more on a tour of Kennedy Space Center. So that was the first time I met Bill. And mainly showed him shuttle activity going on to give him a little flavor that it took a lot of people to get these things ready to go. To tow him through the facilities where shuttle people were getting the next one ready for launch. And so that was kind of that first. I met Bill several other times at more social events, one auction in Long Beach I went to for a charity. So anyway, I met him over the years. A very nice fellow. I was sad to hear, he passed early, quite young. He just started a new series that was quite successful.
Sharon, did you have a question on that?
I sure do. Fred, how did you feel about Bill's portrayal of you and the movie overall? Were you pleased with the movie?
Just going back to Bill Paxton, it was interesting. One of the concerns he had, I was surprised, he said I've never played a live person.
Oh.
I guess in all the movie roles he had, it was either a person that had long since, historic person that had long since been gone, or fictional. And I told him not to worry about it. It was not the life story of Gandhi, only six days. I thought he did a good job. As far as the movie itself, they obviously had some added drama to make it a more exciting action-type movie. If you want to call it from an overall sense, I thought it was excellent to tell the story of people in trouble, which we were, and with challenges that were faced not just by the astronauts, but with people on the ground. Of course, they limited, because they had to limit the size of a cast, to Mission Control, whereas obviously in the real world there were a lot more people in Mission Control involved to work through and solve some of these issues that needed to get worked across the country, in fact, if nothing else, with phone calls for advice and counseling. So anyway, they couldn't have afforded the budget of the real cast. I thought they did a very good job of that, showing teamwork and working adversity pressed with time to get his back.
Fred, we were talking
How
about...
How did your family...
Hold on, I think
I'm
Dan
sorry.
Had a question. Dan had a question.
I'm sorry, Fred. You were talking about as far as the production of the movie itself, and one of the things that the movie did get a lot of claim for was the fact of the realism. So I was just looking up to make sure I had the terminology proper, even though from what my parents had told me when this movie, when you guys were going through this, but the one thing that always gets me that the actors went through was the feeling of the loss of gravity. So therefore, Ron Howard packed up everybody in the, I believe the proper words are reduced gravity aircraft, or more commonly known
as
the
Vomit Comet.
But just to have them go through the realism that you as the astronaut corps had to do as well, did you find yourself just sitting there with a little bit of a giggle going, yeah, I went through that. Have fun with that ride, guys. Enjoy the trip. But also just how realistic they made that part of the movie.
They went to kind of excessive extremes with what they might normally have done to get some free-floating time for the actors. And I think Tom Hanks was kind of one that I think pushed a lot of that. He was a true space fan of the whole group. And I think he pushed that to do some things, extraordinary things. They took the set down when we powered down. I heard they took the whole movie set down to in the 40 degrees or lower, again, to emulate the coldness where we were in the lunar module during that time.
And we're going to talk more about that. Obviously, your experiences there and how realistic the movie was in comparison to what really happened. We are talking with Apollo 13 astronaut and, of course, the Renaissance man, as we heard him, Fred Hayes, and we will be back on WWDB AM 860 Talk Radio right after this.
Hi, I'm Ice-T. As a veteran, I know that for many former servicemen and women, the battle doesn't always end when they come home. Every day, 184 veterans are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, and sadly, 20 take their own lives. When nothing else helps, professionally trained service dogs can. American Humane, serving the U.S. military for over 100 years, rescues animals in need of forever homes and trains them to become free, life-saving service dogs for our nation's veterans. If you're a veteran or know a veteran struggling with post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury, please go to AmericanHumane.org to learn about their Pups for Patriots program. Let's give our veterans a fighting chance.
And We are back to the Weekly Rush with Pete Sharon and Dan. We are with astronaut, Apollo 13 astronaut, Fred Hayes. And Fred's done so much. Fred, I wanted to go a little bit further with regards to the training program. I don't know if you knew this, but I was lucky enough to interview three space shuttle crews, and I actually went in STS-132 Atlantis. I was actually in the full motion simulator, which we'll talk about the space shuttle program, but the full motion simulator over at Johnson Space Center, and was able to do seven launches and six reentries. Now, I say six reentries because on one of them, both the astronauts as well as mission control couldn't figure out what was going wrong, and unfortunately we came in too steep, and unfortunately on that particular, I guess, reentry program, it didn't work out so well. Now, during that time, I was actually observing in the main cabin, and we were upside down and doing all the different things that you would normally do, and of course the simulation is so real in that space shuttle simulator, the full motion simulator. But what really got me was the fact that the bells and the whistles, everything that went off, the alarms, everything that went off was so similar to what was on Apollo 13 in the movie. Is that true? I mean, it was exactly similar to that, when all these bells went off and the booms and all the things that went wrong. What was that like?
Well, the simulator you're talking about, the moving base, first of all, it couldn't go upside down, but it could go at a steep angle and roll, but and give you the feeling when it moved of the some of the real feeling of the motion. And G's, if you will, a little bit, but not like real entries or real launches.
Not even close, yeah.
But they was equipped just as our Apollo ones were, and that simulator you're talking about, the same one we trained for the approach and landing test.
Okay.
It was capable of putting in what we called credible failures across the various systems, electrical, environmental, et cetera, as well as control system. That a team worked for these simulations. That was a combination of mission control and the crew in the simulator to think of this special failures to put in at specific times. And this that was their job. The team in the background called SimSoup, and they to test the crew and to test mission control to work around these problems they would have injected at specific times. And, of course, they worked hard to try to make the crew and mission control look bad.
Okay.
To test them. So that went on for, you know, really hundreds, even thousands of hours of people that had gone through several mission training cycles to prepare them for what might happen in flight. I can't tell you if they had nothing would have compared to Apollo 13.
Yeah, I would think so.
And that, other than that sense that we had a bunch of failures and had warning lights on and that kind of thing. That was the kind of training you went through for all the missions.
Okay, so and this is coming from a person who's never obviously I've never done anything like that. Aerobatics I've done high G maneuvers and everything, but what was it like on launch? I hear there are a lot of G's in the Apollo spacecraft on launch. What was that like?
No, they wasn't. We had a liquid system.
Okay.
Liquid engines in the first stage, second and third stage. So it was there wasn't much kick in the pants on liftoff. Fighter airplanes with afterburners I'd flown gave you more sense of that on takeoff. The most unusual thing of the motion was when the four outer engines of the five gimbaled, that is, moved left, right, or fore and aft, to steer the rocket with that much thrust being moved around through each of those 1.5 million pound engines, thrust engines. It was kind of herky-jerky. It wasn't too smooth. And so you got a lot of jerking around in the cockpit, feeling of being jerked around, although we were strapped in tightly. The G's slowly built as the vehicle got lighter.
Okay.
As it's obviously pouring thousands of gallons of propellant and oxidizer through the five engines every second. And so it was getting lighter as it went uphill, and the G's built up because the same thrust was there with a lighter vehicle now.
Okay.
And it built up, though, only really to 4.5 G's was the max G on the ride, which compared to fighter airplanes, you combat maneuvering, you'd pull 6-7 G's. So it wasn't really a high G ride compared to airplane experience.
I just have one last question, and then we'll move on to your space shuttle days. You know, you're in the Apollo 13. You're in the command module, and of course you hear the banging and all the different noises. And you're trained for a lot of these different things. What was really going through the minds of all three of you when you knew that you had to use the lunar module as a lifeboat? You had to get it up and ready quickly. You had to get around and make sure everything worked. The engines worked and everything like that. Was there any doubt in your mind you guys were not coming back? Or, I mean, did you guys talk about that? Or was it more like we didn't even broach the subject because we knew we were going to make it?
No, we didn't. Actually, you didn't know if you were going to get back before you left. You normally designated a person that would take care of your family, your wife and family, if you didn't make it back. Jerry Carr was my designee, and he came to the house before the launch, and I showed him where paperwork was and that kind of stuff. So Jerry was going to be the one to, primary person at least, to try to make things go as smoothly as they could if I did make it back. Of course, my wife would have been supported by other astronaut wives and other astronauts as well. But Jerry kind of was the person that was the number one person to make sure things went as best they could. So, no, we didn't talk about it. We just did the things that needed to get done in the hopes that everything would work out. There were never any guarantees anywhere along the way.
Well, that's why you guys had the right stuff. I tell you, I've gone to 3 launch parties for the space shuttle astronauts, and there's always somebody, there's always an astronaut there that coordinates the party and basically sometimes a backup to the actual crew members. I guess that's what they would be doing for you, is that they would be at the launch party and they would take care of the family and stuff along those lines. Sharon, do you have any questions?
Yes, along those lines, I was wondering if your wife at that time had ever tried to talk you out of any of these type of trips that you were taking or these anticipated type of expeditions. How did she feel about your career overall? Or did it just go with the territory of what you did?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I was in the test piloting business, which in some respects has its own hazards.
Oh, yeah.
So, and people died in crashes while I was at Edwards. So there was not within NASA at the time, but within Air Force test programs they had going on. So the thought of that, of the hazard, was always there, well, even in the fighter squadrons. When I was in the Marine Corps, we lost people in the squadrons I was in. So, no, I don't think it was, the astronaut program was nothing new in that respect.
That's good. That's good to know. One last question, then we'll go to a break on this, and then we'll go into the space shuttle program. For people coming up right now, obviously we have a new astronaut program, and we'll talk more about that. What do you recommend for people, young people, that want to get into that space program and start flying now? Obviously, there are different companies that are doing it, but what do you recommend people do, girls and boys, in order to get into that space program?
Well, the avenues are still the same, primarily, and probably more of them that will be selected and employed, particularly with Space Station that's ongoing, is a scientific career of some sort, because obviously the main mission and the work that's done on Space Station is with experiments, although to some degree the people that are also flying on the individuals themselves. But going further into like SpaceX is Dragon and there's coming on the Soyuz, there's obviously piloting skills still needed and flying getting up and down. And of course, that'll also be in play for a pilot type skill for the next Artemis mission that's currently being planned and worked to go back to the and land, go back and land on the moon.
That's true, and we'll talk about that when we come back after this break. We are talking with Apollo 13 astronaut Fred Hayes, and we will be back to the Weekly Rush right after this.
Here's an important message for everyone who drives a motor vehicle. Every day, an average of 2 emergency responders are struck by vehicles while working on the road. Some don't survive. Others are critically injured and can no longer perform their life-saving jobs. In 2019, 44 emergency responders were struck and killed while working to help others on the road. Sadly, it looks like that number will be even higher in 2020. Firefighters, police officers, paramedics, tow truck operators, and every responder needs your help, and they need it now. Do your part to keep everyone safe on the road. When you see flashing lights of any color on the road ahead of you, slow down, move over, and give them room to work. It's the law in Pennsylvania. Police are cracking down and penalties for violators are on the rise. This message is brought to you by Penntime and the Beasley Media Group. Learn more about Pennsylvania traffic incident management at penntime.com.
And welcome back to the Weekly Rush with Pete, Sharon, and Dan. We're talking with Apollo 13 astronaut Fred Hayes. Fred, obviously, as we all know, Marine Corps pilot, U.S. Air Force test pilot, also the space shuttle, and of course Apollo 13, where they all came back safely, and that we're so glad about that. Fred, I wanted to talk real quick before we let you go. In 1977, obviously you were slated to go up on Apollo 19, and because of budget cuts, that was canceled. You were also a backup backup for Apollo 16. But then in 1977, you did something even more incredible. Obviously, the space shuttle was just being built, and they had to test fly it. And, of course, you were the one they went to as a commander. You had 5 space shuttle approach and landing tests with the space shuttle flight. Of course, Endeavour was the space shuttle, and that was actually slated to be one of the space shuttles, which right now, by the way, if you all want to go to the Intrepid Museum in New York City, the Endeavour is located right there on the top deck of the Intrepid. What was that like? I mean, now you're getting into a whole different vehicle. You've got to land this this rocket aircraft, if you want to call it, the space shuttle. What was that experience like?
Okay, just a small correction. The vehicle was the Enterprise.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't say the Enterprise. I'm sorry.
Or said
the
Endeavour.
No, you're right.
Okay,
I'm sorry. It's the Enterprise.
No, it's the Enterprise, which actually had a different name, but a Trekkie groups sent a lot of mail-ins or call-ins to the White House even, I guess, in Congress, and they managed to get it changed to the Enterprise. For me, incidentally, there were 2 crews that flew Enterprise, only 2 crews, myself and Gordon Fullerton, were crew 1, and Dick Trulli and Joe Engel were the other crew that we sort of swapped out missions as we went through the test program,
okay,
alternated. And there was kind of a womb in the tomb experience for me because I had left the astronaut office and moved to the, I was interested in program management, and I moved to the Orbiter Project Office led by Aaron Cohen for the design development of the shuttle, and particularly the Enterprise. That was the main vehicle we were working on at the time. So I had 4 years through the design development of the vehicle that I ended up flying for the first time. So like I say, it was kind of womb to tomb experience and actually I look at it as the kind of the highlight of my total flying career.
I would think so. I mean, obviously, the landing an aircraft, a spacecraft, with no power, basically, and it's a glide path. And if you get that wrong, unfortunately, there's no going around. You're like to do that. So, what was that like? That I mean, had you had glider experience or any type of experience with a dead stick before?
Yes, I had more sport flying with gliders, but I had practiced a lot of similar things, assuming engine outs. The 104 was a good trainer for the X-15 in certain configuration. It was exactly like. In fact, shuttle was as a glider was almost identical lift to drag, which is a performance lift or drag is a performance characteristic of a glider. So the space shuttle was about the same as the X-15,
really?
About 4.5. So it wasn't like any big new deal flying Enterprise. And where we separated on these missions, test flights, was right adjacent to the large lake bed at Edwards, so there really wasn't a big navigation problem. The concerns we had with a first vehicle is we weren't going to know truthfully, other than the simulations we had done, engineering sims and our trainers, including the Gulfstream aircraft. We weren't going to know till we separated that first time from the 747 how the flight control, the primary flight control, was really going to work. And so that was the, I want to call if I had any concern about the first flight. As far as the vehicle was concerned, that was it. The rest of it was pretty straightforward in what we were planning to do on that simple first flight. The other concern was programmatic, though. As we're getting ready to fly that flight in August of 77, that January a new president had arrived. Kind of similar situation we have today for Artemis.
Okay.
So we had a change of administration. Jimmy Carter had come in, replacing President Ford. And the program, the space shuttle program, was really known as a President Nixon program.
Okay.
He had started it, got it underway. And we did not have a backup vehicle for Enterprise. We had canceled it early on because of budget cuts, even in the front end of shuttle program, to save money and hold schedule. So there was no backup vehicle. We had also had to announce, NASA had announced, a delay a year or more in the first orbital flight. So it already announced a delay in the program with the tire problems that were seen. So there was that, all that stuff in the background, and I worried most about that flight. Had we hurt Enterprise in some way, or crashed even, would it be the result in the cancellation of the program? So that was my concern. Not safety-wise, the Guard of Fullerton and I, we were sitting in ejection seats.
Okay.
So we had a good escape route. If I was concerned about people, it was the 747 crew. Had we really gone out of control and damaged significantly the 747 as a part of that, they probably, likely, four people would have not got out. So it was not personal safety from that standpoint, life risk for me. Like I said, it was more worrying about what the effect may be on the program had we had the flight not gone well.
Yeah, but it was a first. In other words, this had not been tested before. It was up to you as the commander, actually, on the first several missions to get that space shuttle down and do it pinpointly and do it properly. And each time, it was successful every time. So, you know, kudos to you, Fred. I tell you, you have an amazing career. In everything, and you continue to motivate a lot of different people. One thing I did want to bring up, and then Sharon had one last question about your Guinness Book of World Records, as we'll talk. But there was one time, unfortunately, in a Corvair BT-13, I guess in 1970, you did have a crash on that. What happened there?
Well, it was a Volte vibrator, BT-13. It was a pre-World War II training aircraft, fixed landing gear. You couldn't raise the landing gear.
Okay.
And I was actually ferrying the aircraft from a crop duster's field where we kept it to Galveston Shoals Field to get it on a wash rack, because we had an air show with this private operation that put on air shows with World War II aircraft at Dallas-Fort Worth coming up, and we were going to get it cleaned up for that air show coming up the next weekend. I had got too close on flying formation on another aircraft landing and worried about running over him, overrunning him on the runway, so I did a go-around, put the power on, headed south out toward the Gulf off of that field, Shoals, when the engine quit. And changed tanks and pumped a wobble pump by hand. That would give you fuel pressure and succeed and get the engine, the sputter, off and on for a while to make a turn I did not want to land in the Gulf because I knew it was shallow water.
Yeah.
And I'd probably, with the fixed landing gear, end up upside down and couldn't swim out from under. So I turned it around to land on the far west side of the field, and what I thought was be a smooth area, and it turned out to be the start of where they're going to add in a housing project with ditches.
Oh, my
stuff
goodness.
Dug.
Oh, my goodness.
And it flipped, wheeled, dug into, cartwheeled, ended up, I ended up going upside down backwards, and it caught fire. And before I could get out, I received burns over 65% and got to spend the next 3 months in the University of Texas hospital at Galveston.
Oh, my goodness. But you're okay now, right?
Yep. I flew Enterprise after that.
Oh, wow. That's
something. That was while I was in the program office during that 4 years. And it took me 14 months to get back to flight status. Took quite a bit of physical therapy. But I did get back to flight status, and like I said, was assigned then as commander of Crew 1 to fly Space Shuttle Enterprise.
Wow. Sharon, you had a question.
Yes, I was going to say, on your brave flight out on the Apollo 13, you were 249,000 miles from Earth, and you hold a record. How does that feel to have that record and to have taken that flight? What are your feelings on that?
Well, I wish we had landed and didn't have the record. We didn't know we were making a record, and I frankly don't care. That's pretty soon somebody will beat that record.
Really?
And that brings me to my next question. How do you feel about the space program with Elon Musk and the direction that the country's going now with the space program?
Well, I think Elon Musk, and if you want to call it SpaceX, is doing an incredible job, not just for NASA, but they have a commercial business as well. And the success rate has been phenomenal, and their reuse capability, which obviously is a way of reducing cost to launches, has been great. He's got a bigger booster in mind that I've seen and is working on. It's had some success, but has had trouble landing. And one more recently had a crash. But no, I think it's fine to get him and make use of that asset, which they will do for several of the launches involved in the Artemis program on going back to the moon.
Fred, you were talking as far as with your career, obviously, and you... I like how you just very simply put it that, you read a couple of books, you did some research or whatnot. But as far as the training and the education and the classroom time, what was it like for you adjusting to all of this new and then brand new and evolving technology throughout your career?
Well, I mean, the most evolving has been the use of computing assets.
Uh-huh.
And in some ways it's been more useful, but I worry about it going too much into just because it's available with the capability, the memory capability today, and taking things too far from what I call it simply with less use of software was not needed in what they were trying to do. I think you've seen that in the aircraft business with the Boeing problems.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's better to keep things still simpler and depend more on the piloting aspects, which we've done many, many years, and not need as much total capability, which in some cases is distracting. I think it's the same way with the touch screens in cars and maybe in some degree are adding to accidents rather than helping to prevent accidents.
I tell you one thing. I saw the picture of the actual... touch screens, the three big touch screens they have there, compared to what I saw in the space shuttle simulator, which is kind of like an Airbus configuration. We've come a long way when it comes to technology, especially these three touch screens that they have there. It's been amazing. Listen, Fred, I want to again thank you for your time. I know we ran a little long, but we just love talking to you. You're just an amazing individual. We're talking with Apollo 13 astronaut Fred Hayes. Obviously, he's done a lot more than that. Space Shuttle Commander, as well as so many other things. And Fred, we are just so grateful. We're still in awe that you could be on our show. And we so appreciate it. We hope that you stay safe. We heard that you just got your vaccine. So thank you so much for being on our show. We do appreciate it.
All right. Well, you take care, too, and be safe.
And thank you so much. And that about wraps it up for the Weekly Rush. I'm Pete Chabirko on behalf of myself and Sharon and Dan Fritz. We will talk to you again next week.